And this is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. There's gold in them thar hills. Or is it fool's gold? I don't know. What's to love and what's to hate about the Olympics? I'm very pleased to have with us David Zarin, who writes about the politics of the world's favorite pastime, sports. He's the winner of Sport in Society in Northeastern University School of Journalism's 2011 Excellence in Sports Journalism Award. Most recently, he collaborated with Olympic icon Dr. John Carlos in writing the book, The John Carlos Story, which I absolutely adore.
And Zarin's published Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, A People's History of Sports in the United States, and Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and Promise of Sports. Actually, he's the best darn sports writer in the U.S., and he joins Building Bridges to scrape away at the gold surface and reveal some serious Olympic tarnish.
Dave.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, I must tell you that we stole it. Someone else said it first, but that's okay, that you are the best darn sports writer in the United States. So we are greatly pleased.
Thank you.
And this is
I
the
absolute
right time to have you. Now, I'm torn. I happen to adore sports, and it's hard with a friend's daughter, Leah Neal, who's on the swim team, and John Orozco from the South Bronx, etc., not to get into the individual stories, etc., but what's the real story of the Olympics?
Well, the real issue of the Olympics, to me, the starting point of the Olympics is about displacement, surveillance, and austerity. And if you don't start there, then I don't think we see the whole picture of what we're seeing on our television screens. And I think that has to be the starting point, is recognizing that the International Olympic Committee, which, by the way, is a non-voting actor in the United Nations, it has a seat at the United Nations, is like this stateless, roaming entity. And no matter where it goes, whether it's China or the United Kingdom or Australia or Atlanta, Georgia or Los Angeles, California, there is a familiar pattern, regardless of country, regardless of tradition, regardless of whatever even the Constitution is. What's declared is something that's called a state of exception. And during the state of exception, basically the International Olympic Committee has sovereignty over your country. And what that means is people get displaced without due process, that your budget is going to just balloon, your state deficit of your country is just going to balloon, and it also means an unprecedented amount of surveillance and crackdown on civil liberties. Now, in the post-9/11 world, this has taken on an almost cartoonishly villainous approach in terms of the amount that people's regular lives have been disrupted by the needs of the International Olympic Committee, and London is no exception. Now, I agree with what you're saying, Mimi, as far as loving sports. I love sports. I really do. And the Olympics is special in that it's one of the few times you actually get to see a diversity of sports and women athletes take center stage. And I do enjoy that. I definitely watch it with my daughter as a kind of a girl power thing. She's 8 years old. I want her to see young women on TV succeeding athletically. But the starting point is the reality of what happens when the Olympics come to town.
Well, we're speaking about East London in particular. Maybe you can trace back for us, which I know you did in an article that I thought was exceptional, International Socialism Resistance, the Best Olympic Spirit, where you begin to look and contextualize the contemporary history of the Olympics. And we'll leave my darlings, Venus and Serena Williams alone for a moment, and some of those other great moments. We'll get to that. But help trace for us some of the commercialism, the jingoism that's part of it, the logos, which fit in with what you're saying about the level of displacement and particularly in the context of the austerity budgets, if you will, in Europe?
Sure. Well, I think an interesting starting point when discussing the modern Olympics is actually 1936. Those are known as the Hitler Olympics or the Nazi Olympics. Those are the Olympics that were held in Hitler's Berlin. And why I think that's an interesting starting point is that that was the first Olympics to have things like the running of the torch, the opening ceremonies, the people coming out with the saluting of the flags of all the countries. And it was done as an exercise. It actually started in Hitler's propaganda department, headed by Joseph Goebbels, about how to maximize the Olympics for ultimate propaganda effects for Nazi Germany. And out of that same department came one of the greatest sports documentaries in history by Leni Riefenstahl, about those at Olympiad. It's one of the best documentaries about about the most noxious possible subject. But as far as film goes, it's amazing. I mean, they were very clued in about how to use the Olympics to maximum propagandistic effect. And I start in 1936 because what's so interesting is you don't have Olympics in 1940 or 1944 because, of course, of World War II. But then you get to 1948, and the Olympics are back. Germany is gone. You know, it's east and west and all the rest of it. And yet the trappings that Hitler introduced to the Olympics became the norm from then on. And then they served a different function, of course, during the Cold War, where it was east versus west, and whose society was superior, and that would be determined by the medal counts, depending on who did what and who on each side. It's just a ridiculous spectacle of the Cold War being played out on the Olympic pitch. And then the next big change that needs to be seen is 1984 at the Los Angeles Olympics, because that was the first Olympics that was done with corporate underwriting, headed by Peter Uberoff. And it was also the first Olympics since 1932 to actually make money. And it's also the last Olympics since 1932 to make money, because since then, what you've had is more and more corporate branding of the Olympics, yet corporations kind of wised up after 1984, and they demanded more and more, as they say, skin in the game from the various nation states that were paying for it. And so you then go through 1988 in Seoul, Korea, 1992 in Barcelona, 96 in Atlanta, 2000 in Australia, and then we get to, I think, a very important turning point, which is the 2004 Olympics in Athens, Greece. Why is that important? Well, for two reasons. One, it's the first post-9/11 Olympics. So you have the unprecedented incursion of all kinds of militia forces, et cetera, who are patrolling the grounds with a total abrogation of the Greek Constitution, which forbids troops from foreign troops from occupying their soil. There was a mass occupation of U.S., British, and Israeli troops on Athens soil in 2004. And that was an Olympics that came in at 10 times the budget that they thought it would come in for. 10 times. And they will be paying for those Olympic Games forever. And, of course, Greece has gone through a terrible debt and austerity crisis, as people, I'm sure, listeners are well aware. That crisis has some of its roots in Greek spending for the Olympic Games. A report came out about 3 months ago, I believe it was in the Associated Press, that the homeless of Greece, I should say the newly homeless of Greece, who've been so kicked in the teeth by austerity, are now living in abandoned Olympic facilities, which have no use value now that the Olympics are done.
Well, Dave, you brought up the economics of the game. I wanted to talk about this seems like an Olympics on commercial steroids in terms of the mall that people have to walk through, this giant mall to get to the games, in terms of the brand police that go throughout the stadiums looking to make sure that nobody's using sneakers that are not branded from the sponsors of the game. Why don't you talk a bit about the commercialization of the Olympics in London and how that's,
absolutely,
is it something qualitatively different than before?
Yeah, and just for the sake of your listeners, I should know that I was in London for just about all of May, so I saw all this firsthand with my own eyes. I'm not speaking on the basis of reports I've read or emails I've received. This is all stuff I saw. What I'm about to say is all stuff I saw with my own two eyes. You know, advertisers believe, Adweek magazine, you know, the leading publications of Madison Avenue, believe, and they think it's provable, that association with the Olympics is the best possible thing that could happen with a corporation. People tend to associate very, very positive virtues to companies that are Olympic sponsors. So naturally, there's a rush to sponsor the Olympics and an overbidding process to sponsor the Olympics by companies that actually need that kind of spit shine. In other words, the worse a company is, the more likely they're going to try to grab that Olympic ring and be a sponsor. So look at who the four main sponsors of these Olympics are. I'll do three of the main sponsors of these Olympics. One is Dow Chemical, One is BP, British Petroleum, and one is McDonald's. And their brands are everywhere. They are all over London. And it is something to see. And it is causing a great deal of friction in London. And we'll go through the, well, I mean, British Petroleum, it should be obvious, both from my environmentalists in London, and it's got a very large environmental community, as well as BP's own history. It is something that, you know, of course, has people up in arms that BP is being pushed in their face every corner. Dow Chemical is particularly noxious because there is a large South Asian population in London. And Dow Chemical bought Union Carbide, which was responsible for the Bhopal disaster, which killed, I believe, 20,000 people in India several decades ago. And one of the things that Dow Chemical promised when they bought Union Carbide was that they would make restitution in Bhopal, and they never did. So that being in people's face is very extreme. And then, of course, McDonald's in and of itself, just a general affront to people's sense of health, which, of course, the Olympics brings all of this propaganda that they're bringing, like a movement for health to a country, a movement of exercise to a country. And yet for these Olympic Games, the largest McDonald's on earth was built in the Olympic Village.
Dave, I know that we might as well tackle then the issue of geopolitics. There are people who God, they're crying over China's metals. My goodness, what has happened? But the question, with all seriousness, of there are those now who are suggesting that aside from basketball players, who of course are pros, and the whole question of what's happened to amateur sports, assuming such a thing exists anymore, but they get a lot of money. Phelps, of course, got a lot of money for endorsements and stuff. But oh my God, the poor Olympic individuals, we should have federal financing, the hell with health care and single payer, but we should have federal financing. Or maybe what we should do is what China does and rest the children away at the prime age of 6 months and begin to cultivate them so we too can re-enter the metal sphere. Talk about really, notwithstanding some of my flippancy here, the kind of geopolitics of this game, which we're told is about peace and love, but clearly I would say that's very low on the priority.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. I mean, if it's about peace and love, that doesn't explain why there are missile launchers attached to the roofs of residential apartment buildings in London.
Precisely.
Tough love.
Right now, that's tough love, exactly.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though. I do want to respond to something you said, though, because I think when people look at China and the way they do athletics, and what you said is absolutely correct as far as like resting children away at a very young age if they show even a glimmer of athletic talent and putting them on the train towards the Olympics and national glory, we should not think that this country is that different. It's not done by the state. It's done instead by the psychological implantation into tons of families, particularly working class families, that this is the only way out for their kids and that it's worth every possible sacrifice to get your kids to the Olympics. Like, take Michael Phelps, for example. I'm a big defender of Michael Phelps, partly because my wife grew up near him in a working-class area, North Baltimore. Like, he's a working-class kid. He's 27 years old. He has basically had a full-time job since he was 6 years old. And now he's 27. And you could sort of see it in his face. He's kind of like, the hell with this. I do not need this. And it's really hard to blame him. And then another story by one of the female U.S. gymnasts about how she was sent away from her home to get the best possible training and cried every single night, missing her family. And then she called her mother, who's a working-class single mom, called her mother and said, Mom, I want to come home. I'm done with it. And the mother's response is to a child, meanwhile. And NBC is saying this with the swelling music as if this is somehow positive, keep in mind. And the mother says to her child, and she says this to NBC, she says, I said to her, well, then you're going to have to look in the mirror and answer your question to yourself about why you quit every day for the rest of your life. I mean, can you imagine as a parent saying that to your child who's crying because they're in some faraway place being training with an East European emigre lunatics like the Caroli family, Bella and Martha Caroli, and getting back. I mean, it really is something that I think what bothers me the most is not that the families go through this. And I don't even blame the families, because that is the setup that we have as sports in this country. What really, really bothers me more than anything, is the fact that it's glorified, that it's not seen as a human tragedy, that so many families have to go through this in order to grab the Olympic ring.
Dave, I know there was a demonstration in London over the weekend on Saturday, which there were arrests. What's bothering people in London about the Olympics, and also what's happening with civil liberties there?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because there was a 1,000-person protest on Saturday, and that's a great thing. It's a great thing that they had the protest. It's from a group called the Counter Olympics Network. And it's also great that they did it without getting smashed by the police. And I think it's not that they didn't get smashed out of the goodness of the hearts of the people in London, of like the political officials in London, but they didn't get smashed because they did so much publicity beforehand that was highlighting the fact that they were doing this protest, that it put the British in kind of the British police, the authorities, in kind of a no-win situation where they just had to sort of let the protest happen. And the people's reasons for protesting are, I mean, it's a variety of things, but the starting point is what I started with, which is displacement, the crackdown on civil liberties, and the fact that the price estimates for these games are so above and beyond what was promised back when they won the bid in 2005. All of those things together have created a lot of dissatisfaction in London amongst people. And you know what's causing even more dissatisfaction now is, and it swelled the ranks of the protest, is that people watch the games on TV and there are so many empty seats in the stadiums. And this was after people in the UK were told that there wouldn't be tickets for them. And in one of the articles I wrote about it, it reminded me of the line in Annie Hall where Woody Allen said about the two women, and they say, one says, this restaurant is terrible, and the other said, yeah, and the portions are so small. That's how people, in my experience, and I really did talk to a lot of people on the ground when I was there, like every chance I got, that really was the reaction. Like, people were upset about the Olympics, upset at the disruption, and upset that they couldn't get tickets all at the same time. And honestly, I don't see these things as necessarily contradictory. I see it as very human, because you sort of feel like, well, geez, you know, it's like, I'm paying for this. Like, I don't want to see it. You know, it's like people who are upset about the amount of taxes they have to pay, and then they don't get decent pickup of their trash. It's like, it's understandable why people would want decent pickup of their trash. So it's the best way to put it is that people just feel screwed over every which way but loose, and respond in a very, you know, sort of like, you know, a machine gun shooting all over the place, just mad at everything that's connected to it. And but I'm glad that they were able to have a protest and have visible dissent. The irony in talking to some of those protest organizers is that it made news throughout the world, but effectively did not get any news coverage in the UK itself.
Well, you know, one of the other things, I just hearken back for a moment, really, to your book, The John Carlos Story. I still remember, it really was a pivotal memory for me, watching that Olympic stage during the juxtaposition with the murder of members of the Black Panther Party here, during the emergence of the Black Power movement, perhaps one of the seminal movements on which shoulders the women's rights and the gay rights movement and so many other, the American Indian movement, all of those really are a tribute to those movements. And watching John Carlos make that venue into a truly liberatory process, and one where there had habitually been a lack of diversity, an African-American athlete standing there with his fist raised proudly and buoyantly along with Tommy Smith, truly one of the great moments. Is there any possibility for, can there be any utilization, or has it been totally quashed by the Olympic committees, by Avery, the Brundages and the Samarash and stuff, where we can never again have that moment of seeing sports in a liberatory context? We certainly have that problem here in our sports, in baseball and football. We know what happens to athletes who speak out. What do you think?
Well, we've seen some interesting things happen in recent years, like the entire Phoenix Suns team a couple of years ago in 2010, all wearing Los Suns jerseys. And that's something that never happened in the 1960s, a whole team coming out. And they did it, of course, to protest Arizona's SB 1070 laws and did it as a team. That had never happened before. Similarly, we never could have predicted a year ago that Jeremy Lin would change the way we talk about not just Asian American athletes, but Asian Americans in the United States just by playing point guard for the Knicks. I mean, the point is that I think we're going to be surprised. And I think it's going to be difficult to expect people to do things like they did them before in 1968. People are going to have to make their own way, their own path, and do it in a way that makes sense for these times. The only thing I would caution about Smith and Carlos for today is to tell folks to remember that it's not like Tommy Smith and John Carlos went to Mexico City to protest the Mexican government. They went there to protest their own government, the United States. So that's going to be, I think, the pivotal question is, and that's what made it so brave, frankly. If you think about all the patriotism and all the propaganda that's drilled into these athletes' heads, is anyone going to have the courage to say, wait a minute, you know, I'm being sent here to foster a lie about the United States being a land of equal opportunity and where anyone can make it if they try hard enough? I mean, that's really what pushed Smith and Carlos over the edge, where they felt like they had to do something. They felt like they were being sent to export a lie to the world. Like, oh, look at all these black athletes. Clearly there's no racism in the United States. And that's why they felt like they had to stand up. And there certainly are enough issues for people to stand up. This is a historic year in many respects. There are more women U.S. Olympians than men. There are 22 openly LGBT athletes playing in these Olympics. So these are things that we should keep an eye on. There are also a ton of athletes who've taken to Twitter to protest something called Rule 40, which basically means that they're not allowed to profit off their own image during the course of the Olympic Games. And a lot of athletes see that as being, you know, ridiculous. You know, it's like, so everybody gets paid but us. This is outrageous. All of those things, just anytime people step out of their box and start to speak out, it just lessens the vice a little bit and provides a little more breathing room for athletes to just be heard about the issues that really matter to them.
And at the same time where you've raised these issues, indeed, we can look at somebody like Caster Semenyan and what is happening, virtually being tortured, being experimented on virtually as they begin to look at the idea of binary gender norms. How do we understand, how do we place that in a great athlete like this sister and what has happened to her on the world stage? And I have to say, my God, go Usain Bolt. But anyway, we can talk about my partisanship in some of the events later on.
Yeah, it's just that people probably know Caster Semenya's story. I mean, she's been subject to vicious gender testing, which all started with the Australian team at the Worlds, who were protesting that she was probably, as they said, too much like a man, and that they wanted her tested. And it's so disgusting for so many reasons. I mean, gender is a fluid social construct, and some people are born with different levels of testosterone. Other people, you know, some people are born intersex. There's a lot more gender fluidity than you would know by, you know, popular culture. And Caster Semenya, there's no evidence that she was taking any drugs whatsoever, which can, of course, create that kind of gender fluidity. It was naturally her. And it was one of the rewarding things in an otherwise bombastic opening ceremonies to see her actually carrying the flag for South Africa.
Yes,
the fact that
yes.
She was chosen for that, the fact that people like Winnie Mandela have backed her up, and the fact that people in South Africa have really seen it also as an issue of racism, which it is something that I think is something worth celebrating, the fact that she wasn't bullied out of these games.
And since you mentioned South Africa, I know that you've spent a good deal of time looking at a role of the great South African anti-apartheid struggler and poet Dennis Brutus, and how he used sports as leverage to make an impact on politics. So as we move to, unfortunately, the conclusion of this wonderful discussion with you, what do you tell our listeners and some of the people who are more cynical in the progressive venue about the significance and the importance of sports, and maybe a quick summary of the totality of the Olympics.
Yeah, I certainly wish I had more time to go through all that. But I will say quickly that I think it's important for people to recognize that there are two traditions in the history of sports. There's the George Steinbrenner tradition, which most people find disgusting, and it's a reason why people don't like sports. And then there's the Muhammad Ali, the Billie Jean King, the Arthur Ashe, the Tommy Smith, the John Carlos, the Martina Navratilova tradition. And this is where sports, at its highest apex, really, has been used as a vehicle of social protest. And it's an important thing to recognize that history, because for a lot of people, that is really how they got schooled in their own radicalization. And also for a lot of people, and it's not always about athletes raising their fist on a medal stand. Like, for a lot of people in this country, a country where more people watch ESPN than the nightly news, that's their introduction to politics. Their introduction to issues about race is from talking about Jeremy Lin. Their introduction to any sort of discussion about gender becomes one about women athletes. And I think it's important that people who see themselves on the left be conversant in these topics, if for no other reason, that it's a very, very important way to just communicate with people about the world in which we live.
Hey, I love sports. Was rejected from the Winter Olympics. My father got into the, was a runner from the Penn Relays into the Olympics. And there's much more to say. And I hope we can spend some more time with you, because there are an awful lot of important issues to explore in this most critical pastime of the world communities.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on the show, both of you.
It is our pleasure and honor. And again, I really insist, go out, folks, and get the John Carlos story. It is great. Not to mention the other books, but let's start with that. David Zarin, thanks. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.